The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The big question about Trump is very much alive. And I think Trump is really the only one where there is a compelling case that he engaged in insurrection. It's a high bar. You need to overcome First Amendment hurdles. But he is getting there.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 13th, 2022. Roger Parloff is a senior editor at Lawfare. He has been following, in a way that just about nobody else has, the litigation to keep people off ballots under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. You remember Section 3. It's the part of the 14th Amendment that says if you engaged in an insurrection, you're excluded from public office. It was the subject of a major Fourth Circuit opinion the other day, and the state of Section 3 litigation is also the subject of a significant new Roger Parloff piece on Lawfare entitled After the Cawthorn Ruling, Can Trump Be Saved from Section 3 of the 14th Amendment? Roger joined me in the virtual jungle studio to talk through the piece. What are the major legal arguments that people involved in January 6th are using to keep themselves on the ballots? How strong are the factual cases against different gubernatorial and congressional actors? And why is Donald Trump uniquely vulnerable to a challenge on this basis? It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 13th. Roger Parloff talks Madison Cawthorn, Donald Trump, and Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. All right, so I want to start with the Fourth Circuit ruling in the Madison Cawthorn case. But before we do, let's situate the conversation a little bit. We are talking about a raft of challenges to legislators and others' presence on ballots around the country because of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So for those for whom that sounds like gibberish, what is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and why are there challenges to a variety of Republican officials and candidates on the basis of it?
Right. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was enacted, you know, after the Civil War, ratified in 1868. And the idea was that if you had been involved in the rebellion, and it's written in a gnarly way. In essence, if you had already sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution, and then you supported the Confederacy, you were disqualified from holding a long list of offices. So that's basically Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And it's written in a way that it doesn't just apply to the Confederacy. It also applies clearly to things that happen in the future, insurrections, rebellions, giving aid or comfort to enemies of the United States. All of these subject you to a disability under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And Congress is empowered under this section to lift those disabilities if it wants by a two-thirds vote of each house of Congress. So that's Section 3. And so after the insurrection, everyone began to know, of January 6th, everyone began to think, well, wait a minute, is this an insurrection? And if so, does that mean that maybe officials that were involved in this, including President Trump, might be disqualified from future office under this provision?
All right. So Madison Cawthorn is one of the people who has faced a petition for disqualification. Let's talk about the case against him. What did the petitioners allege, and how did this end up in the Fourth Circuit?
Yeah, the allegations were not particularly strong, I'd say. And that's true of most of these cases so far. You know, he had made statements that were, he promulgated the false election fraud claims, and he, you know, supported the Stop the Steal rallies, and made some other inflammatory statements on the day and even afterwards. But I think that without discovery showing more than that, it was weak in terms of the robust protections that First Amendment provides to political speech. And that's true of most of these so far. But North Carolina had a good procedure for challenging a candidate to say they were disqualified for office. And so some voters who were backed by a nonprofit group availed themselves of that procedure, challenged him, tried to get discovery, failed. But meanwhile, he went into federal court to block the whole proceeding. And the main argument that his lawyer proposed was that this Amnesty Act of 1872, which I guess I should explain to you, covered Cawthorn. Now, the Amnesty Act of 1872, this was 4 years after Section 3 was ratified. It was a partial amnesty that really lifted these disabilities from thousands of Confederates that were covered by it, probably around 17,000. So it was en masse, but it didn't reach everybody. It got most of the lower officials. So his lawyer was saying that the wording of the 1870 Amnesty Act was actually broad enough that it had prospective effect, that it reached out into the future and lifted disabilities on future insurrectionists. This was an improbable claim that many scholars had not even anticipated. But the judge in North Carolina, the Eastern District of North Carolina, Richard Myers, surprisingly accepted that claim, and then that was appealed to the Fourth Circuit.
So by the time the Fourth Circuit rules on this, Madison Cawthorn has already lost his primary election bid to return to office. So why is the case not moot, and what did the Fourth Circuit find?
Yeah, that is certainly an oddity about the case. He lost the primary May 17th, and the 73-page ruling came down on the 24th. And what they said was that, well, the election hasn't been certified yet, so it's still a live question. And reading between the lines, I think you might think that, gee, they found the questions interesting. They'd written 73 pages and they didn't want to throw it in the wastebasket. But they did give that reason that was the reason it wasn't moot.
All right. So what did they find on the question of the Amnesty Act of 1872?
They really gave it the back of their hand, this argument. They said to ask such a question is nearly to answer it. The notion that the 1872 legislation prospectively lifted the disability 150 years in the future. They did not see the textual argument for it, and there had never been any historical argument. It had always been a purportedly textual argument. Nobody thinks any legislator was thinking about the future in 1872. So a second judge had meanwhile also rejected the Amnesty Act claim. I sort of think this is the end of the Amnesty Act claim. But it was obviously sort of for the Republican Party, it was a deus ex machina. It would eliminate all of these claims. There have now been 9. And of course, all of these are sort of warm-up acts in case Trump runs, because that's the big question all of these are really laying the foundation for.
All right. So let's talk that through, because I think that there's a sense in which all of these cases are petering out. But there's also a sense in which they are, as you say, a warm-up act, and each of them is establishing something that may be deployable in the context of a second or third Trump candidacy. So you said there have been 9 of these cases. In most of them, as I understand your analysis of it, you don't think there's a case because you don't think these people have meaningfully engaged in insurrection.
Yes.
But that's a fact claim. That's sort of the last piece of analysis, right? Before you get to that, there are all these claims like the Amnesty Act stuff that are sort of as a matter of law. So what are the other, as you say, deus ex machina legal claims that would kind of wipe things out so you don't even have to think about the question of whether the candidate in question engaged in insurrection?
Yeah, there are at least 3 others. One of them, it only applies to U.S. senators and U.S. representatives, but that's a lot of who the cases have been filed against so far. And it says that under Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution, each House of Congress is the exclusive judge of the qualifications of its members. That's the argument. And this was first really advanced by Professor Derek Muller, and he advanced it long before the insurrection, January 6th. And so it's a very respectable argument. People disagree with it, saying that Article 1, Section 4 modifies, gives the states some powers to control the way that elections are run, including elections for federal officers, and that allows them to judge the qualifications of candidates. So that's been a lively issue. The courts have sort of been all over the map about that so far. But the important thing is it doesn't reach state candidates. And most importantly, it doesn't reach presidential candidates. So it won't save Trump.
Right. Even if the House of Representatives and the Senate have exclusive authority to decide whether to admit an elected member who may have engaged in insurrection, that has nothing to do with qualifications to be the president. Right.
Exactly.
All right. So what's the second one?
The next one, it's based on an 1869 case called Griffin's case. It's basically the notion that Section 3 is not, quote, self-executing, unquote. So what happened in Griffin's case, it was before a circuit court, and the judge was Chief Justice Salmon Chase, and maybe I'm not pronouncing that correctly, but he was acting as a circuit judge. And the case was a habeas corpus. It was brought by a freed slave who had been convicted of a felony, a shooting with intent to kill. And he was saying, well, my conviction can't count because the judge who presided at my trial should have been disqualified under Section 3 because of his involvement in the Confederacy. And of course, his judge had been involved in the Confederacy. And this was not an isolated case. There were a lot of criminal defendants, in this situation. And so Chase said, you know what? Section 3 isn't self-executing, meaning until Congress enacts a law explaining how to enforce it, this judge was entitled to stay in his job. And as a result, the conviction stands. And so that's the notion that Section 3 isn't self-executing. After Griffin's case, in fact, Congress did enact enabling legislation that explained how you could enforce it, but that was later repealed. So the argument today is, well, there's no enabling act. All of these are dead on arrival. It's not self-executing. That sounds like a pretty good argument until you learn more about the context, which is that a few months before Griffin's case, the same judge, Chief Justice Chase, sat on a different case involving, actually it involved Jefferson Davis, the former president of the Confederacy, and he had ruled the other way in a different context. He said, it is self-executing. Historians like Gerard Malioka, who wrote about this, he wrote about Section 3 at length in a Law Review article that came out in December 2020, so 1 month before the January 6th, which gives it a lot of credibility. He noted that he didn't think Griffin's case was convincing, especially in light of the fact that the same judge had come out the other way a few months earlier. And in addition, and he thought so for several other reasons, including the fact that other sections of the 14th Amendment, like Section 1, are self-executing.
It seems like, though, that there's a very specific piece of evidence that Section 3 is self-executing, which is that Section 3 gives Congress the ability to remove the disability, but it doesn't say Congress needs can impose the disability. The disability, you know, it describes a congressional action by two-thirds vote to remove it, but it just describes the disability as existing.
Right. Well, that's a fair argument. I haven't heard anyone make it, actually. I think those that argue the other way look to the Section 5 of the 14th Amendment and say, see, that gives Congress the power to enforce the 14th Amendment. And so they say, well, that's how they were supposed to do it. I think another argument that it is self-executing is that prior to Griffin's case, people were ousted under it. Prior to there being any enabling act, a lot of people were ousted under Section 3 without any enabling act. And there are rulings, you know, by federal circuit courts, by the state Supreme Courts. We have those rulings, and Congress ousted people under it without any enabling act. I think several justices of the Tennessee Supreme Court were ousted. You know, there's a lot of history that was, you know, by people that were there when this was ratified that thought this was self-executing. So I don't think it's that strong an argument.
So what's the third deus ex machina argument?
Merely committing insurrection does not disqualify you from anything. You have to first take an oath and then commit insurrection. Furthermore, you have to take an oath for a certain list of offices and then commit insurrection, and then it applies. But even then, it only applies to another list of offices, which isn't identical to the first list. So it's a very complex thing, and it never uses the word president. It uses a couple categories that sound to me and to you probably like they would include president, like any officer of the United States, but that's the nub. So a couple professors, Josh Blackman and S.B. Tillman, Seth Tillman, have argued that that phrase, an officer of the United States, is also used in Article 2, I believe, of the Constitution. And there, it does not mean president. It means people that are appointed or commissioned by the president. So they argue, well, maybe that's what this means, that they chose that phrase and it doesn't include the president. Now, you know, obviously that would be a strange thing, but at the time that they were doing this, you know, Lincoln was not the problem. Lincoln had not committed an insurrection. Maybe they didn't, you know, conceivably envision a situation where the president himself would lead the insurrection. So that's the argument. Most people think it's a little tortured and exceedingly improbable. There's no support for it in the legislative history, but there's no refutation of it either. One senator, I think, had noticed when they were discussing Section 3 that, in as far as he read it, it didn't refer to the president. And another senator said, "Well, no, let me direct your attention." And he directed the person's attention to a phrase in there that said, "Any office under the United States." That is technically, that's actually in the second list of offices, any office under the United States, as opposed to any officer of the United States. And Blackmun and Tillman offer no opinion about whether that second phrase might include the president. But the first phrase, which is the ones who actually took an oath, which oaths matter, they claim that does not include the president. So the weird thing would be, what that means is, okay, President Trump committed an insurrection. You can, you know, we could all agree on that. But because the only oath he took at the time of the insurrection was one to become president, he's not covered by it. That's the argument.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023. And angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is delete me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports, at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then Each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
So where does this all leave us? You have the Fourth Circuit, which doesn't control around the country, but does control in the Fourth Circuit, saying that the Amnesty Act stuff is off limits. You have scattered different non-controlling precedents with respect to Congress's exclusive authority to adjudicate these, and you have no authority with respect to either whether the president is covered or whether it's self-executing. And yet we have a whole bunch of these cases that have been kind of decided on other grounds or sometimes on these grounds around the country. So where do you think we are with these disqualification cases at this point?
Let me just make one little footnote to what you said. One judge in three cases, in a case involving three cases, three challenges in Arizona, a superior court in Arizona, did accept the self-executing argument. He said that Section 3 was not self-executing. That was one of several bases for dismissing it. And then on appeal, this Arizona Supreme Court affirmed, but on narrower grounds, so not reaching. So there's a, you know, there's a tad of support in the case law, I guess, for the theory that it's not self-executing. Where does it leave us? You know, it turns out to be very important to bring these, what sorts of provisions the state has for challenging the qualifications of a candidate. Because if you just go into court, certainly a federal court, and seek a declaratory judgment saying, I don't think so-and-so is qualified, you don't have standing. And so there might not be that many states that have these procedures. We're waiting to see, you know, maybe if Pennsylvania might. We don't know if these not-for-profits are planning more attacks, but they might not be able to. And then, but I do think the big question about Trump is very much alive. And I think also, I think factually, Trump is really the only one where there is a compelling case that he engaged in insurrection. It's a high bar. You need to overcome First Amendment hurdles, but he is getting there.
But before we get to the merits of the Trump case, I want to talk about the mechanics of the Trump case. So now imagine it's a year and a half from now, and Donald Trump rides down the escalator at Mar-a-Lago and announces that, not that there is one, but announces that he's running for president again. And a whole bunch of people move to in different states to keep him off the ballot. You just said a whole bunch of them won't have standing. So does that mean there's no way to adjudicate it in those states, or that this is a non-starter in those states, or that there's some other means of adjudicating it in those states?
We have to see how clever the lawyers are. There clearly is a mechanism in North Carolina and in Georgia, and I assume in a lot of other states where there weren't people that the nonprofits wanted to target. But I have not done a review of that, and they won't tell me what their research shows. But what I assume is, yeah, we would get a lot of these challenges through local procedures. And then given how strong the case is, it's hard to believe that at least one of those officials, you know, you have 51 jurisdictions, at least one or several would not try to keep him off the ballot. So that would quickly bring the Supreme Court into the picture, I think.
So you imagine that eventually, that basically the mechanism is there are a few states where there are clear procedures. The case against Trump is strong enough that petitioners might win in one, and that would actually cause the federal courts and perhaps the Supreme Court to rule in a fashion that would then control the other states.
I think probably even before you get to a ruling disqualifying him, the Trump campaign would run into federal court and begin to invoke these deus ex machina arguments. And I think at that point, it would go up to the Supreme Court.
All right. So let's talk about the merits of the case against Trump versus the others. First of all, why are the cases against the other people? Is there anybody other than Trump who is a plausible national candidate or a statewide candidate or congressional candidate who you think there is a plausible Section 3 case against? And what makes Trump's situation different to the extent that he's uniquely in a dangerous situation here?
Well, the one remaining Section 3 challenge that's still alive right now is closer than the others to plausibility. It involves somebody that was actually convicted of a crime relating to January 6th. He was there. That's Coy Griffin. He was a county commissioner from Otero County, New Mexico. But it was a misdemeanor. He did not go inside the building. He was outside the building with a bullhorn. And he was actually acquitted of a second misdemeanor for disorderly conduct. The judge, Trevor McFadden, found that when he led the crowd in prayer using the bullhorn, he may have been trying to calm them down rather than rile them up. And so he acquitted on a disorderly conduct charge. And that raised, you know, can you really be guilty of insurrection if you were acquitted on disorderly conduct?
No, it was a very orderly insurrection.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a tough one. But I think with Trump, you know, obviously we know more about him. The January 6th committee has been investigating. We've got the Department of Justice has charged more than 820 people, and we've learned a lot about, through their cases, a bit about the impact that Trump was having on them. And we have a couple important district court rulings, federal district court rulings that are pretty powerful. One of those was Judge Amit Mehta in a civil case, several civil cases, where police officers and some congressmen have sued Trump under the Ku Klux Klan Act for, in essence, forcibly trying to obstruct the certification of the election. So very close to inciting the riot and an insurrection. And he allowed the case to go forward against a motion to dismiss. He allowed those cases to go forward. And the key question was whether he could overcome the very steep First Amendment protections that exist for political speech under Brandenburg versus Ohio. And he found that under the really unique situations here, that the cases could proceed. There was a strong case that he had gone over the line and had incited the insurrection. I don't know if he used the word insurrection, but he had incited the riot. And he does a very close analysis of, the 3 months leading up to January 6th, and also sort of a line-by-line exegesis of the 75-minute speech at the Ellipse. And it's, in my humble opinion, pretty convincing. So that is one thing. And, of course, you could say, well, that's just a motion to dismiss. He's just accepting the allegations as true. That's not based on evidence, which is technically true. But all of the evidence, all of the allegations he was discussing, virtually all of them, are undisputed. The text of all those tweets and speeches and video appearances is uncontestable. And then what happened afterwards is uncontestable. We have it on terabytes of video.
But what if a subsequent appellate court, say either the D.C. Circuit or the Supreme Court, says, as a matter of law, Judge Mehta is wrong, and this is, under Brandenburg, protected speech. And therefore, you know, it may have caused the insurrection, but it's not actionable. Does that affect whether he has engaged in insurrection for 14th Amendment purposes?
Well, I think it does. I mean, I don't think anyone knows that for sure.
Yeah.
Obviously, this was written before, Section 3 and the 14th Amendment were written before we interpreted the First Amendment the way we do. I can't imagine a contemporary court saying this is an exception to the First Amendment. I think they would try to harmonize them.
So at this stage, your bottom line essentially is that no sitting member of Congress or likely congressional candidate has a serious Section 3 problem, but Donald Trump still potentially does. Is that fair?
That's right. And the reason I say that is that we know right now so little. We know uniquely little about what the representatives and senators did, the pro-Trump representatives and senators, because for the most part, the January 6th committee has been very delicate in not sending out subpoenas to them. They have sent, I think, five, and those four have been, and at least four have been rebuffed. So we know very little about their role. We've gotten a few emails through Meadows. And then so far, the vote challengers have failed to obtain discovery in the state level proceedings that allow for vote challenges. Those proceedings do provide for discovery in theory, but those proceedings are really built for qualifications. The sorts of qualifications that are ordinarily being contested are like, are you a citizen? Are you a resident of the state? Are you 21? These are relatively easy things to establish or not, or disprove. And in fact, usually the burden is on the candidate to show these things. So the administrative law judges or whoever the official is that decides is not used to granting extravagant, subpoenas and document production. And also all of this stuff is on an incredibly compressed timeline. It's usually the candidate registers and, 6 weeks later, there's the primary. So you've got to decide this very quickly. And a Section 3 challenge is, an allegation that you engaged in insurrection. That's just a huge litigation. And so we really just don't seem to be able to learn enough about these senators and representatives. Now, if something happens, things could change. And I,
I guess just this morning, you know, for instance, a Republican gubernatorial candidate was arrested for a January 6th involvement. I think it's a misdemeanor so far, Ryan Kelly. But, you know, things could change. But no, so far with the First Amendment and how little discovery we have, I haven't seen a convincing Section 3 case for them.
So what are we looking for in this area going forward? Are we just going to sort of sit back and wait until either the factual landscape changes with respect to any 2022 gubernatorial or congressional candidate, or are we going to wait until Donald Trump files in one of the relevant states and a challenge emerges?
There could be more challenges. The group that has done the most challenging is called Free Speech for People, and they've declined comment on whether they plan additional challenges. They've already sent letters to every Secretary of State in the country, putting them on notice that they regard Trump as disqualified. They did send a letter relating to Doug Mastriano, who's now running for governor in Pennsylvania, but I don't know what Pennsylvania's procedures are and if they're going to have a procedure that enables them to challenge him. So we could see a few more, and of course the we might get a result in the Coy Griffin case in New Mexico. But yeah, I think we're waiting. And like you say, it will matter if we learn more about what happens in the Ku Klux Klan cases that Judge Mehta was ruling on, if there is a reversal on appeal.
We are going to leave it there. In the meantime, Roger Parloff, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the ever-patient Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Hey, folks, I know I nag you about this every now and then, but I really mean it this time. You should promote the Lawfare Podcast, tweet about it, share us on Facebook, make TikTok videos about the Lawfare Podcast. There aren't enough TikTok videos about the Lawfare Podcast. And for God's sake, leave a rating or review wherever you found it. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.